Hello, Bitcoiners, Wellians, and people who just want to learn. This is Zach, and you're listening to Explains on the Bitcoin Well podcast. We've changed our schedule up a bit. This show will now come out every Thursday instead of Tuesday because Adam O'Brien, our CEO, has a new YouTube show that'll be coming out every other Tuesday. So he wanted to make room on our YouTube page to be able to promote what he's doing. It's called The Adam O'Brien Show, and it's not just another Bitcoin show. It's an interview show about getting into deep topics that have nothing to do with Bitcoin, exploring faith and reality and humanity in all its aspects. And I'm sure Bitcoin will come up from time to time, but it's not the main focus. So go check out what he's doing and give him a subscribe and a like or two. Now today we have a fun one. We're exploring the governance of Bitcoin and its separation of powers. We'll also be getting into the block size wars from 2017, where there was an attempted coup in Bitcoin and all of the properties that make Bitcoin, Bitcoin, were stress tested to an extreme degree. So stay tuned to relax into some knowledge and learn more about how Bitcoin works and about one of the most dramatic moments in its history. As always, please email me any questions or concerns to z.adair@bitcoinwell.com, and I'll catch you on the next one. Enjoy the show. In the last video, we ended with a question that I want to come back to. Miners spend hundreds of millions of dollars building warehouses full of specialized hardware. They process every transaction, they build every block, they collect every reward. In any other industry, that kind of capital investment buys you influence. It buys you a seat at the table. It buys you the ability to make the rules. So what stops the five biggest mining corporations from walking into a boardroom, signing a piece of paper, and rewriting Bitcoin's supply cap? Well, in 2017, they actually tried. They had the biggest mining pools, they had the major exchanges, they had the venture capital firms, they had over 80% of the network's computing power behind them, and they signed an agreement to change Bitcoin's rules by force. They lost completely, embarrassingly. And today, we're going to talk about why. We're going to meet the quietest, most underappreciated participants in the Bitcoin network, the node operators. And we're going to tell the story of the block size war, the moment regular people with laptops beat Wall Street in a straight fight. To understand Bitcoin's governance, you need to understand its separation of powers. Think about a football game. The players on the field are pretty important, wouldn't you say? Without them, there's no game. But the players don't make the rules. If a running back decides he wants to pick up the ball and throw it forward twice on the same play, he can try, but the referee is going to blow the whistle and erase the play. It doesn't matter how big he is. It doesn't matter how much energy he spent. The play was invalid, and that's final. In Bitcoin, miners are the players. Nodes are the referees. A node is just a computer running the Bitcoin software and keeping a full, up-to-date copy of the entire ledger. Every transaction going all the way back to the Genesis block in 2009. Here's how it works in practice. A miner finds a new block and broadcasts it to the network. But before that block gets added to the chain, every node independently checks it. Did the miner issue too much new Bitcoin? Are the digital signatures valid? Did anyone try to spend the same coin twice? If the miner broke even one rule, even a small one, the nodes reject the block outright. That miner just burned thousands of dollars in electricity for a block that doesn't exist. Miners only get paid if the nodes accept their work. In other words, miners propose, nodes dispose. So who runs these nodes? Well, you can. Right now. On hardware you probably already own. You don't need a warehouse. You don't need specialized chips. You can run a Bitcoin node on a 5-year-old or hell, 10-year-old laptop or a $100 Raspberry Pi. Right now, tens of thousands of independent nodes are running all over the world, in living rooms and basements and small offices. Most of the people running them aren't paid to do it. They do it because they want to verify the rules themselves. This accessibility is not an accident. Satoshi deliberately kept the block size small, meaning the amount of data each block carries is intentionally light. And the reason is important. If Bitcoin processed terabytes of data per day the way Visa does, only massive corporations could afford the server farms required to run a node. And if only corporations can run nodes, corporations are the only referees. The network then centralizes, and you're back to trusting JP Morgan's ledger instead of verifying the math yourself. By keeping nodes cheap to run, Bitcoin ensures that anyone can be a referee. You don't have to trust the bank. You can check the work on the laptop sitting on your kitchen table. That's not a small thing. That's the whole thing. Now, the obvious question. If nodes run the software, who writes the software? Can't the programmers just sneak in a change and slip it past everyone? This brings us to the third group in Bitcoin's balance of power, the developers. Unlike your bank software, which is a closely guarded secret, Bitcoin is completely open source. Every line of code is publicly hosted on the internet. Anyone on Earth can read it, audit it, or look for bugs. There are no secrets in the codebase. Developers propose changes through a formal process called Bitcoin Improvement Proposals, or BIPs for short. They publish their ideas, debate them for months or sometimes years, write the code, and test it exhaustively. So what's the rub? Well, developers have zero power to force anything. A developer can spend 2 years writing a brilliant piece of code. They can publish it to the world. But if tens of thousands of node operators look at that code and decide they don't want it, the code goes nowhere. It dies. Developers write the menu, and nodes decide what they want to order. This makes Bitcoin slow to change by design. In Silicon Valley, the mantra is move fast and break things. That works fine for a social media company. It is catastrophic for a global monetary network where people are storing their life savings. When it comes to sound money, slow is not a bug, slow is a feature. In 2017, this whole system got stress tested in the most dramatic way possible. As Bitcoin grew in popularity, the network started getting congested. Because block sizes were intentionally kept small, space in each block was limited. Transaction fees started climbing, wait times increased. The corporate side of the industry, big mining pools, major exchanges, and venture capital firms looked at this and said it was a problem that needed fixing. Their proposed solution was simple: increase the block size, process more transactions per block, scale up. They held a closed-door meeting in New York. The people in that room controlled over 80% of the network's mining power and nearly all of the major corporate infrastructure. They signed what became known as the New York Agreement, a pact to update the software and force larger blocks onto the network on a specific date. The assumption was that if you control 80% of the hash rate and all the major exchanges, everyone else will fall in line. But they forgot about the nodes. The cypherpunks, the independent developers, the people running nodes in their basements. They looked at the New York Agreement and immediately saw what it actually was. Not a scaling solution, a power grab. If block sizes increased, running a node would gradually become too expensive for regular people. Eventually, only corporations could afford to referee the network. We actually see this in other cryptocurrencies today, like Ethereum. Because Ethereum processes so much data and complex smart contracts, running a full node requires massive, expensive hardware as a result. The average person can't do it. A huge percentage of Ethereum nodes are simply hosted in the cloud on Amazon Web Services. If AWS goes down, or if Amazon decides they don't like crypto, a massive chunk of the network goes dark. That's not a decentralized network. That's a corporate database. If Bitcoin went down that path, it would become a corporate coin. The whole point of it, trustless, permissionless, verifiable by anyone, would be gone. So anyway, back to the New York Agreement. The users organized, they launched something called UASF, the User Activated Soft Fork. Thousands of independent node operators around the world updated their software with one new rule. On August 1st, 2017, any block submitted using the New York Agreement code would be rejected outright, ignored, as if it never existed. Think about what this means for the miners. They had billions of dollars in hardware. They had massive operational infrastructure. But if the nodes refused to recognize their blocks, that hardware produced nothing. They would be mining a version of Bitcoin that the actual economic network refused to accept. Worthless. It was a game of chicken with enormous stakes. The entire industry was watching. August 1st came, and the corporations blinked. The New York Agreement collapsed. The takeover failed. A small group of dissenters split off anyway and created a copycat coin called Bitcoin Cash, or Bcash, with bigger blocks.
You are a cheerleader of Bcash, so people point at you as somebody that would be the source.
Continue insulting me? I'm not interested in continuing. It's Bitcoin Cash.
Roger, the only reason you want to call it Bitcoin Cash is because you want to co-opt the brand.
It's Bitcoin. Read my lips.
You know, it's Bitcoin Cash. I think that there are only three people that want to call Bitcoin Cash Bitcoin Cash. You and Jahan and your sock puppets, okay? Because there's nobody else.
I've never hired a single sock puppet. I don't need to be insulted. But please post this so the entire world can see how incredibly rude you are to me.
Today, Bitcoin Cash has lost nearly 99% of its value against Bitcoin and is largely irrelevant. The nodes won. The block size war settled something no white paper could. It proved that Bitcoin cannot be coerced. It doesn't matter how much money you have, how much hardware you control, or how many CEOs are in the room. You can't force the network to change its rules. Bitcoin isn't governed by democracy, and it isn't governed by boardrooms. It's governed by voluntary consensus among independent, self-interested parties. Developers propose, miners execute, and nodes verify. Each group checks the other. No single group can go rogue without the others pushing back. No one is in charge, which means no one can corrupt it. Now, up to this point, we've talked a lot about the big picture, how the network works. We've covered miners, nodes, difficulty adjustments, and halvings. But how do you actually interact with the system? When you own Bitcoin, what do you actually own? Where is it stored? And how do you keep it safe? In our next four-part series, Wallets, Keys, and Seeds, we're going to bring it all down to the personal level. In the very first video, we're going to dive into public and private keys, the cryptography that gives you ultimate ownership and ensures that no one on Earth can spend your Bitcoin but you. See you there.